This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello and welcome to Ahval podcast and video series, Hot Pursuit. Today, I am joined by Professor Howard Eisenstadt, Associated Professor with St. Lawrence University, upstate New York. Hello, Howard. Nice to have you.
Hi, Abu. It's good to be with you again.
Well, we have some issues to talk about. Of course, these are high times for Turkish-American relations, and I did a series of talks with top experts, and I would like to hear your takes and comments and assessments as well about the state of things between Washington, D.C. and Ankara. And things seem very tense, to say the least, but there are, you know, issues and sub-issues to discuss. Overall, I think, can it be said that Nick Danforth, as he described it, from a stage of, you know, strategic partnership no longer, but strategic ally, but he's suggesting Brookings Institution report that he wrote for, it's now from strategic ally to strategic threat. It's that kind of a radical shift, he suggests, is has been happening. What do you think?
I thought Nick's piece for Brookings was brilliant. I think that Turkey and the U.S. Turkey and the U.S. are going to continue to have areas of partnership, but I think the general tableau is one of increasing tension. I don't think it's an either or. I think that there will continue to be places where the two cooperate. I think that fundamentally Turkey has been thinking differently about the U.S. for many years, and I think the U.S. has come to think differently about Turkey as well.
The nature of relationship has changed radically. Can we say that? Because suggestion is, I think, by Max Hoffman, Center for American Progress, containment or cooperation. And also it is mentioned in Nick Danforth's report, and other similar mentions have been done by Carnegie Europe, Mark Pierini. The nature, the core nature of the relationship has been changing between Turkey and the West now. Irreversible, yeah. Perhaps.
No, I think it's true. I guess I would say that what we're seeing is less a sharp turning point than you know, sort of a long-term trend that's reached a point where people are speaking openly about it. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, at its core, Turkey sees itself as an ascendant power, and it sees the United States as a declining hegemon. And as such, Turkey's looking for ways to assert itself without sort of cutting all ties or breaking all relations. There's still benefits for Turkey to engaging with the U.S., but I think fundamentally it sees the U.S. as not simply a rival, but a declining rival.
With a lot of suspicion all over it.
Yeah, I mean, I and we can talk more about this later, but I tend to take Turkish political leaders' rhetoric literally much of the time, and I think when Soylu talks about Turkey as being behind, or the U.S. as having a hand in the attempted coup of 2016, I think that we should take that seriously and assume that there's a level of belief there.
Mm. What, in your opinion, caused this massive foreign policy change in Ankara? Ever since, let's say, the shift of power from Obama to Trump administration, let's go back like 4 or 5 years, attempted coup, maybe even before, What do you think that the root causes or main causes are about this change? Was it sort of filling the vacuum, utilitarian approach? Okay, Trump is no longer in the region. Let's fill in the vacuums and do, or some, what do you think?
So I'm actually going to go back 20, I'm a historian, so I'm inclined to do this. I'm going to go back 20 years, maybe even 30, and say that Turkey's
back
basic
to the end of Cold War, you mean?
Yeah, that Turkey's basic assessment that the United States is a declining hegemon is accurate, that the United States is, in fact, a relatively less powerful state, that there has been a broad trend, certainly since the end of the Bush administration, so the beginning of the Obama administration, for the U.S. to look for ways to become less directly engaged with the Middle East. And as such, there is space for regional powers, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Israel, to sort of step into the gap. And I think that it's utterly unsurprising that Turkey, which has long believed, and by long I mean for many decades, believed that it had a natural role of leadership, not only in the region, but in the world, to try to step into that gap. It has the wherewithal, it has the sense of sort of national mission. And so at a very basic level, I think that much of this is structural. I think that U.S. decisions and Turkish decisions along the way certainly facilitated and exacerbated a greater break. And again, I would start with the U.S. invasion of Iraq. As sort of a major turning point, and the failure of that invasion, right? The failure of the U.S. to accomplish its goals of sort of stabilizing Iraq. It seems to me that it was clear that Turkey would take a more aggressive role. There, you know, we can go through the long list of ways in which the U.S. and Turkey have worked at cross purposes, the ways in which Turkey has seen its strategic, what it sees as core strategic values undermined. We can talk as well about Turkish mismanagement, and I think there's been plenty of that. But to my mind, the core of this is actually structural and in a sense natural. Did it need to be as rancorous as it is? No, absolutely not. And I think there's certainly a fair amount of mismanagement on both sides that made it worse than it needed to be.
And if you look at the past 5 years, come closer to today, you know, you hear very many views. Erdogan's viewpoint is United States is behind this coup, which doesn't seem to have changed. Even there are some suggestions that the S-400 purchases linked to that sense of intimidation, fear, and also the power structure in the period 30 years ago is entirely different than the power structure now in Turkey. Actors are different. Those were the times where people spoke a lot about military tutelage, and now we have different stage. You know, we have a very powerful Diyanet, we have a very, very powerful ultra president or super president, and also his coalition, loose coalition, but ideologically quite glued to each other, like synthesis of Islamists and ultra nationalists. So that kind of constellation, I think, needs some explanation as well for the what Nick Danforth calls combative foreign policy or combative regional policy.
So, and I'm instinctively contrarian. So, it's not that I entirely disagree with you, but Eurasianist trends.
Diversity of opinion is always valuable.
Eurasianist trends have been a large element of even the Kemalist military for a long, long time. Yes. You know, and you know, sort of the ambitions that I talked about, I think that those are actually sort of a consensus among a whole series of different, you know, what we would think of as typically factions within Turkey. I don't see the break as ideological per se, though I think that there are ways in which the Islamist elements of Turkish foreign policy are more pronounced in moments in specific places. But
there's certainly a breach between then, peace at home, peace right. of the world, motto of Ataturk, and today.
I think the big difference is the context in which Turkey's acting. But here's the way that I think things have changed pretty radically. The first is that I think the Syrian civil war and the U.S. and Turkey working at cross purposes there greatly exacerbated tensions, and I think fundamentally the two states had what they saw as core interests in Syria, and they weren't aligned, and the U.S. support of the YPG, I don't think it came out of thin air. I think it came out of those disagreements, but I think that it represented a fundamental break. The other thing that I would point to, and that I think is really distinctive, isn't so much ideological as it is, as it were, bureaucratic, which is that I think Turkish foreign policy has become much, much more personalized. I think that its personalization has resulted in lurches. It has resulted in bad messaging, and it's resulted in, to my mind, very incautious decision making. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, so if you want to put us on a shorter time frame, and again, 5 years is a little bit too short for me, but the last 10 years, I think that the personalization and the pushing aside of sort of bureaucratic input and bureaucratic wisdom has fundamentally changed the tenor of how Turkey engages with its allies.
It's interesting because it's about the decade we are talking about, actually, because of the Mavi Marmara incident, which is exactly. about 10 years ago, and also more.
Yeah, and the 1 minute moment at Davos. Right? So, you know, right around 2009, I guess, would be.
And
you know,
also the almost entirely personal intervention of Erdogan in breaking apart, tearing apart protocol process with Armenia, which is well, also about 10 years ago. I think your assessment is correct in a way that those were sort of, you know, very strong signs about those changes that were to take place.
And let's think about, again, sort of a context that was the moment I think predates the Arab uprisings, but the Arab uprisings really accelerated that process mm-hmm. because Ankara was convinced, Erdogan was convinced, that the Arab uprisings represented Turkey's moment. Mm-hmm. And it engaged very, very aggressively in trying to shape events in ways that, you know, it's come with successes and failures, but it wasn't particularly interested in coordinating with the West. Rather, it saw itself as being in a position where it could lead the West. And I think that ambition is not something that we would have seen with the old guard. The old guard would have taken a very cautious approach to the Arab uprisings.
Right. But the reactions when it started to fail, I mean, there was an over-optimism, especially by Davutoğlu, et cetera, that the Syrian war would end in six months and et cetera, et cetera. None of these predictions proved to be true. And then the reactions came like in a domino effect, like Turkey losing its regular relationships with Egypt, with Israel, very, very cold relationship with Lebanon. The entire neighborhood turned against it, and which we see the results of today. And then what we see now is a sort of a showdown between Washington and Ankara. So reactions were like 180 degrees to what that optimism was representing. And I think that needs also some explanation. As you said, in conscious decision making, is it sort of impulsive sort of decision process that sort of alienated all the institutions, basic institutions of Turkish state, which also happened?
I'm not sure I understood the question.
No, the question is why, how to explain this turning against all these regional actors when Arab awakening, you know, backlashed.
I wouldn't say all regional actors. I think that's something of an exaggeration, but I think that effectively Turkey saw itself as an anti-status quo power, mm-hmm. and it was betting. It saw in the Arab uprisings a populist religious nationalism akin to its own. And in aggregate, the story of the Arab uprisings has been a retrenchment of the status quo. And so if Turkey was sort of backing the status quo, then you know, that the regimes, you know, Saudi Arabia and Egypt were are two of the most prominent. The regimes that were most invested in maintaining the status quo were going to be on opposite sides of the pole. But I'm actually not as pessimistic, I think, as you are about Turkey's overall condition. I think that Turkey's
not only, but most of these reports are gloomy. Center for
America. I think there's serious tensions between the U.S. and Turkey, but I think that Turkey's position in the Middle East is not universally bad. I think that the tensions, you know, and the tensions with Europe are significant, but I think that both sides need each other quite a bit. Mm. I think tensions with the U.S. are pretty awful, but I think they're awful relative to our expectations of what they should be, rather than, you know, I don't think that Turkey's another Iran. I don't think it's going to be treated as a consistent rival. I think there's going to be areas of cooperation, but I would also say that the U.S. and Turkey are less important for each other than they once were. And I would contrast that to Turkey and the EU, who also have significant points of tension, but actually need each other. And so, you know, my basic take is that the U.S. and Turkey can sort of decouple a little bit, and neither will suffer any great harm. Turkey's relationship with the EU is very different. They're much more intimately tied. The economic relations are much, much, much more significant. The political repercussions of a real break are much more significant. And I think they're to the extent that we're talking about Turkey and the West, I think that we need to separate out Turkey and the US and Turkey and the EU.
Mm-hmm. You know, when we talk about Turkey and United States, I think we should have, you know, Trump era, you know, in the context as well. You have been a very sharp and constant observer of these shifts and changes and shades and light and everything about these relations in the past 5 years, following the failed coup and takeover of Trump in November 2016. Looking at today, Turkey today, all these shifts have been taking place, international policy from point of view. Is Turkey now closer to Russia? Where is Turkey now in terms of the overall international politics picture?
Sorry. I guess my response would be that Turkey is more or less where Ankara would like it to be, which is a relatively independent actor with significant structural relations with the West and engagement with other parties, Russia, China, that give it a degree of independence. I think from my own perspective, that relative independence gives it less freedom than it imagines. And I think the S-400s are actually a really good example of that. I don't think that Turkey's trying to join with Russia or join with China against the West. I think that Ankara's aim is to achieve greater independence, to pursue a more, as it were, non-aligned policy. And I think that that's been relatively successful in achieving that. Whether that's in fact in its best interests or giving it the kinds of freedom of movement that it imagines is a separate question.
Mm-hmm. But we see now growing attempts from Ankara by Hulusi Akar, by Ibrahim Kalın, to, you know, open channels and ways to communicate with Biden administration, which remains so far unresponded. There's a wall there. In that context, what as James Jeffrey points out, he says the main problem is S-400s. We are talking about today, of course, and tomorrow maybe. Is it really so? Do you agree with that? And I think, how will these sort of miscommunications evolve in your opinion?
The S-400s are a really big problem, but I think the main problem is that Turkey would like to maintain as much cooperation with the West as it can, but
on its own.
Also, what's that?
On its own terms.
On its own terms, and the question is, if you, as you transition to those that sort of relationship, what are the terms? I mean, the S-400s to me are less a they're a significant problem, but they're also reflective of a larger problem, which is that Turkey, quite rightly, said, "Well, we're a sovereign state, and we have the right to make choices that we see in our best interests." But when you're making those sorts of choices, you have to recognize what those choices mean for other parties and what those other parties' response might be. And I think that Turkey has assumed that transactionalism would simply mean Turkey was going to, you know, take the steps that were in Turkey's best interest, and its partners would accept that. And then that's not how transactionalism works.
Right. And other than that, S-400 issue, which I think will continue to be a headache. Other flashpoints that you see that we will be facing in the near future?
For Turkish-U.S. relations, I think there's a whole bunch of outstanding issues that are not likely to get solved anytime soon. And I think that, I think the U.S. support for the YPG, if I were advising Turkey, I would say, you know, let sleeping dogs lie and the problem will go away over time. Because I don't think that the U.S. has any long-term interest there. But that's not the way, that message wouldn't be received in Ankara, and it's not the way Ankara perceives it. I think the Halk Bank issue is going to loom large, I think.
In about 2 weeks or 3 weeks now.
Is that true? Okay. Mm-hmm. I think what happened with some of these issues is that the Erdogan government bet on good relations with Trump, sort of putting these things in hibernation, and that strategy is obviously not going to work. And so we're just going to have to live with these tensions. But I don't see. In the end, the growing tensions between the U.S. and Turkey aren't existential. I think they're going to get worse. I think the bigger issues are in the Eastern Mediterranean, Cyprus, and the U.S. is frankly a relatively marginal player in those tensions. And those from Ankara's perspective, I think. Its relations with the EU are the much more serious ones. Mm. For the U.S., I don't think the relation's going to be strong for the foreseeable future. I think the rhetoric from Ankara is necessarily going to heat up, but I'm not sure that represents a real change.
You said relations may be worse in the future between U.S. and Turkey.
Yeah, in the short and medium term, I can only imagine the fact that there's no easy solution to the S-400 or the YPG. The fact that there's going to be these additional issues on Cyprus, on Halk Bank. The fact that Turkey seeing no real solutions is going to, you know, they're going to engage with colorful rhetoric, and you know, pundits will respond accordingly. Mm-hmm. Right. I think tensions are going to be somewhat worse. I'm just not sure how important that is in the long term for either Turkey or the U.S. I think that we can afford to not be very good friends.
Mm. Erdogan's opponents from different parts of the spectrum may like it or not, but he was successful in sort of delaying at least the Halk Bank process by, you know, as reported by New York Times, etc., and by us as well. There were lots of instrumentalizations happening there in the American judiciary, but now Trump is gone. But what we hear and what we report here is that still there are people in strong circles in palace those kinds of efforts should continue and must continue, and maybe it's possible that they will continue through Biden administration to delay at least the Halk Bank process. I am just curious to know, how convinced are you, given the fact that Biden-Harris administration has come to power with the pledge on the emphasis of democracy and human rights, not only domestically, but also, I mean, not only giving autonomy full autonomy to Justice Department, but also internationally. Right. How convinced are you that this will pledge will be followed through in case of Turkey? Because it is a serious case study about breaches of human rights.
So I guess I'd say two things. The first is that the Biden administration has very little reason right now to compromise with Turkey on rule of law in the U.S. or which would be the Halkbank case, or human rights in Turkey, rule of law in Turkey for that matter. I'm thinking of the Kavala case, where the State Department quite rightly issued a statement this past week, and Boazici as well.
Boazici as well, yes. And LGBT as well.
I think that were Turkey a really consistent and supportive ally, the Biden administration might cynically soft sell some of the domestic repression. Given that Turkey is not a particularly reliable ally, and in fact often seen as an opponent, there's no reason to soft sell that. I mean, the Trump administration, which was very easygoing about repression in Russia or Turkey, was quite vociferous about repression in Iran. So I think one level of this is, yes, the Biden administration might turn a blind eye to some of the repression at home, but it has no reason to, right? There's no sort of practical reason to avoid talking about these things. The second component, and maybe the more important one, is I think that the Biden administration has come in with a general strategy of reinforcing that America is back, by which they mean that the America of rule of law and international relations and sort of institutional connections, the United States that works through institutions and follows law and says and supports those things which we expect the United States to support, that the Biden administration wants to reinforce the message that those things are back in play. And we're seeing this across the board, not just on Turkey. But I think that if there's hope that somehow the Biden administration is going to finagle things on the Halkbank, I think that in a larger strategic sense, not just about Turkey, Turkey's one small country from the U.S. perspective. Mm. In a larger strategic sense, that goes against the grain of what the Biden administration is trying to do. The Biden administration overall is trying to demonstrate that institutions and laws and rules are back in play, that the sort of ad hoc transactionalism and personalized relations that defined the negotiations with the Trump administration are no longer going to be sort of determining forces in U.S. policy.
Mm-hmm. And that will not make the relationship between Turkey and America easier, of course, this kind of approach.
No, Trump was a godsend for Turkey. I mean, I don't think he was a godsend for Turkey. I think he was a godsend for the Erdogan administration. The Erdogan government found it very easy to work with Trump because Trump was everything that the Erdogan government thought it knew about America to begin with, that it was corrupt, that it was easily manipulated, that it was fundamentally venal, and that was made things easy.
Mm. Well, we talked about rendition policies, etc., with Nate Schenck and Freedom House, but also there's this part of this scheme is the hostage diplomacy, as some pointed out. It worked to a degree with Trump administration, with the Brunson case. Now there's a lot of strong, insistent talk that the way Osman Kavala is held, continued to be held in jail, and also the attempts to merge Gezi indictment together with espionage indictment, etc. It's turning, you know, the aim is to turn it into a huge political trial, studying kind of type of thing, in the 1930s. Do you think this kind of hostage taking and exchange, you know, Kavala in return for watering down of Halkbank case, for example, will work with the Biden administration?
No, I don't think that sort of crass transactionalism would work. I think that it would be wise if Turkey wants to signal that it's serious about negotiations on more substantive issues, then it would certainly be wise to release some major political prisoners, Kavala and Demirtas, most notably, to sort of highlight that it's really serious. But I don't, as a practical term, I that would be sort of part of a general signaling campaign rather than some a tit for tat.
I see. Just two more questions and we are through. One is the letter signed by 54 senators of Congress, which was, of course, in its nature quite unprecedented because it was bipartisan. Never before had we seen anything of that sort between two countries in that kind of context. I don't remember, at least. Maybe you do.
I'm actually thinking of the Turkish attack on protesters in Washington a few years back, attacked by Erdogan security services. I believe a similar sort of letter was produced, but. You're right. It's certainly, I don't know if it's unprecedented. It's certainly significant.
Significant. Okay. And it caused a splash, certainly. And, from Ankara, there was also this, bipartisan response, pointing out the fact that Enes Kanter had visited Congress and talked to the senators. So suddenly we have this Gulen or Gulenist dimension into it. But what is your take? I think you reacted to it in social media.
So I guess my first reaction is it represents a broadly held consensus in Congress that you know has been there for a long while, but now is more significant because the Biden administration's in power.
It was brewing for years and years. Yes,
that Turkey's no longer a friend, and that its human rights record is appalling, which it is. It's appalling. The decision to include somebody so closely affiliated with the Gulen movement struck me as reflective of the lack of sort of expert input into the letter. It's not the targeting of his family is, of course, appalling, repugnant, an attack on human rights. I'm not I don't want to suggest that what Turkey has done is appropriate, but it was dumb, right? As a strategy, highlighting a member of the Gulen movement within the letter was not strategically smart. I have to believe that had they asked any Turkish expert, what do you think of this text, it wouldn't have gotten a favorable review. But the truth is that. Experts aren't necessarily given editing rights over these things, and I'm sure that there are people in the Senate who were very happy to attach themselves to a professional basketball player, it says something kind of depressing about decision making in Washington, but there you go.
Does it diminish the sort of influence or effect of the letter in the eyes of the White House?
Does it diminish in the eyes of the White House? No, I think that from the perspective of the White House, it reinforces the idea that a tougher line on Turkey would be generally popular and bipartisan. Mm. I don't think the Biden White House is terribly concerned about the.
I see.
Does it give it fodder for outrage in Turkey? Sure. Mm-hmm. It gives fodder for outrage on Turkey, on social media, but I'm not sure how important it is one way or the other.
Okay, final question is, please give us your take on the future in terms of, the past 5 years, especially state of emergency, has left almost no segment of the opposition untouched, in negative terms, of course. There's a lot of suffering. There is, of course, a growing and deepening economic, social, even cultural, moral crisis in Turkey. What, in your opinion, would the sort of disintegrated opposition, political opposition of Turkey do in terms of sort of strengthening or restoring, if you will, the relations between these two allies? The Turkish opposition I'm talking about.
I'm not sure that the Turkish opposition has much that it can do, at least publicly. Privately, of course, they can send all the messages they want, but I'm not sure that they can do much tangibly in public. And frankly, I'm not sure that it would be wise to do so. Mm. I'm not sure that Erdogan would much prefer going and will do everything in his power to go into the next election continue to believe that it will not be an early election. I continue to believe that it will be as scheduled. He would like to go into the election wrapped in the flag. And to the extent that the opposition spoke out openly in support of its alliances with the U.S. or the EU, I think it merely facilitates him wrapping himself in the flag. The United States is wildly unpopular in Turkey, but it's been wildly unpopular in Turkey for a long, long time. And were the AKP out of power, the United States would continue to be wildly unpopular. Mm. I'm not sure that the opposition has any interest in publicly embracing the U.S. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where it gets votes there. And, to the extent that the opposition has a chance, it has to maximize its support. Mm.
And, yeah, let's end here. I think we covered a lot of ground here. And one final question, maybe your take on, for example, what Nick Danforth and others sort of speculate about, whether or not, two segments of the Biden administration about Turkey. Let's get tough type of guys and let's continue to find, areas of cooperation type of guys. Which ones would be more dominating, you think?
I don't think that there's actually that much division. I've heard some people in Washington take a scorched earth approach. Yeah. We've got to make an object lesson out of Turkey and demonstrate that you can't mess with the U.S. I think that they're a minority position. I think that they're I don't recall very many of those people having a great influence over the Biden administration. I think that what's going to happen is the U.S. is going to get tougher, but it's still going to search out places for cooperation. And I don't think that that's mutually exclusive. Right. I think that in the end, a transactional relationship, which is where Erdogan's going to be more comfortable, I think that's fine. But transactions require both sides to recognize what the other side wants and needs. And so, you know, getting tougher and moving towards a more transactional relationship, they're not mutually exclusive.
Howard Eisenstadt, associated professor with St. Lawrence University in upstate New York. Thank you, Howard, for this conversation.
Yavuz, it's always a pleasure.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.